Chairperson, to qualify briefly, my name is Bo, and I'm an alcoholic. That's my qualification. Does anybody have a desire to drink today? Boy, that's neat, isn't it? Saturday night, a room full of alcoholics, and nobody has a desire to drink. The power of this program, isn't it? And with that, Dick's going to introduce the speaker for us. Thank you, guys.
I'm Dick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Nate.
And my early days of sobriety, I used to try to talk to new people in the met in the groups and try to tell them about how it works. And one of these guys, we talked about it and we knelt down together and prayed a nondescript kind of a prayer, which I've done that with a lot of people. And you never know whether anything is going on or not. Sometimes you do, but most of the time you just have hope. And you're going to hear the result of our mutual hope tonight as Jim P. gives us his testimony. So welcome Jim P. with a good round of applause.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Jim.
And I introduce myself that way because I always have to remember what I am before I tell you who I am. I'm an alcoholic. And I've known Dick for many, many years, and I appreciate him asking me to speak here tonight. And the last time I saw this gentleman, he was marrying somebody, so don't be doing that tonight, okay?
No.
You were in that same outfit, too, when you were marrying him.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Very good clothes.
Yeah, you get around. I've been asked here to kind of share my experience, strength, and hope, what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. I'm alive by the grace of God. There's no doubt about that. And Dick did have a prayer session with me way before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't ready, but the seed was planted, and for that I'm entirely grateful. I was and this is like it says in there, this is my opinion, but I've talked to a lot of medical experts and things like that. I believe when I was born, and that was April 1st of 1954, I was an alcoholic. I just feel like this disease is a hereditary disease. Neither one of my parents were alcoholics. My father was an Air Force commander. Mother was the base commander's wife, and so she didn't drink very much. My dad didn't drink very much. Both of my grandfathers were raging alcoholics, the kind that Bill and Bob were. I mean, they just couldn't ever stay sober. And I didn't have much interaction with them, but when I did, it was never fun because they would never come home until the kids were asleep, but I'd stay awake to see what happened when they came home. And they were so verbally abusive to my grandmothers, and both of those people were saints. And both of my grandfathers died at a pretty early age, mid-60s, and they died as a direct result of this disease. I was looking at some films of me the other day when my dad was taking us 8mm films. I had them transposed over to a DVD. And boy, that just clinched it right there, man. You know, you can see my three older sisters, and they were all polite. My older brother, he's kind of goofy. And there was me, sticking my tongue out every time the camera was on me. And I just, you know, restless, irritable, discontented. You know, we lived in Japan. I set the field on fire one time, trying to roast marshmallows. Always in trouble. Always in trouble. We moved around a lot. And I'd like to blame all these different things of never having a real place to live, because in the military we're moving every couple of years. I can't blame any of that. I'm an alcoholic. That's why I'm here today. You know, it has nothing to do with my surroundings or anything I've been through. We moved to a place in Duluth, Minnesota. And I always say, if you have a chance to go there, pass, because it's not a very nice place. It's really cold up there. But I was 11 years old. My oldest sister got married. And at the reception, the colonel said that everybody could take a sip of the champagne that came out of the fountain. And we toasted my sister. Everybody else sipped theirs, and I gulped mine down. And that happened. It happened right then. You know, that golden moment we hear about. You know, that did something to me, and it did it to where I went back to that champagne fountain four more times before they figured out I was over there getting drunk. And they put me in bed. And I really don't know anything other than the bed was spinning, and then my stomach was spinning, and, you know, of course I threw up. And I came to the next morning, you know, 11-year-old boy came to, and it felt like there was a man in my head with an anvil and a sledgehammer just pounding away. And maybe some of you had had a headache like that before, but I mean, it hurt. And I could taste that stale vomit in my mouth. And I couldn't wait to do it again. Couldn't wait to do it again. Now, you want to talk about a sick person? Many, many years went by before I ever even knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I chased that golden moment all those years, and I never found it again, but I chased it, and I chased it with a fever. We moved down here in 1966. I got in with a bunch of guys that were like me, that liked to get drunk. We were too young to have a job, and so how do you get money to get alcohol if you don't have a job? You steal. And I became pretty proficient at breaking into your house, taking your stuff to get my booze. And I always say this because I mean it, you know. If you or your family members got broke into between 1968 and 1972, I'm sorry. You know, it's a big town. There just wasn't that many burglars in this town back in 68. And I know I was, you know, we were hitting 3 and 4 houses a night. And I really am sorry because I was sick for a long time. And alcoholism is a disease. I'm convinced of that today. And what we are is sick people trying to get better, you know. I thought at one time I was a sick person trying to get well, and for 3.5 years when I first came here, I kept getting well, and I kept getting drunk. You know, so I don't get well anymore. I just try to get better one day at a time. I was incorrigible. I didn't like school. And so whenever my dad was TDY or gone, I was a hellion run wild. I was the fifth child out of six. My youngest brother was born 10 years later than me. And everybody else in the family was goody two-shoes, but somebody had to be the black sheep, and that was me. My mother declared me incorrigible, and I was sent to the juvenile home up on Michigan Street back when it was just a little square building and a bunch of dead orange groves. And our job was to pick up the dead oranges and go to school. Damn! You know, I hated school, and here I am locked up and having to go to school anyway. You know, but I didn't pay attention to school. I paid attention to the other people that were in there with me, and what they taught me is burglary. You know, I went from breaking and entering to a burglar. Every time I got out of there, I got better at it. They never taught me about wearing gloves, and so everywhere I went, I left my fingerprints, and that is how, you know, I came to know the law system pretty well. But I spent a good part of my youth in juvenile detention, 13, 14, 15, 16. I was there more than I was free most of the time. And never once was I thinking alcohol was a problem or I had a problem with alcohol. I just kept getting caught, you know. And that was what was in my mind. I got out of juvenile detention and went back on another tear, breaking and entering, burglary, armed robbery. I graduated and put a gun in my hand, and thankfully, I never shot anybody. I never raped anybody. I was in a blackout an awful lot of times. And so I say that with all honesty, but it's really telling you, I don't know, you know. But I'm hoping I didn't. You know, I was drunk almost 24/7 when I was younger. And pretty soon they came and arrested me again. You know, I thought they'd get tired of it, but they didn't. Took me back to jail. And I knew this one was going to go bad. I was 17 years old, and they had me for a whole list of stuff. And I know it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill Oakley said one time when he shared before he passed away that when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't chase two rabbits with one dog. And what he means is you don't talk about drugs and alcohol. There'll be a couple spots in my story where a drug pops in and out, and I can't help it. It's my story, but drugs, you know, were a big part of my life, but that's not what brought me here. I begged my dad when I was 17 to bail me out one more time. I was sincere. I wasn't going to do this anymore. I wasn't sincere. I made him think I was sincere, but he didn't think he should do it. But my mother, God rest her, she told him to go ahead and get me out one more time. And I got out, and that night I broke into his gun case. I took the .45 automatic that he carried through three wars. I went over the back wall of our yard, and I took off. You know. How sincere is that? Less than 24 hours after begging to get out, I'm stealing from him and taking off to California. In California, I came down with hepatitis C, and I still had a military ID card, so I was admitted to a military base out there. Now, all the bases here had my wanted poster in the PX, and I'm out in a military base in California getting treated. You know, go figure that, because I've got that poster at my house right now. A friend of mine broke into there one day and stole it for me. And I don't ever want to forget things. You know, I don't want to regret the past. I'm not real thrilled with some of my past, but I don't regret it because that's all I've got to give to anybody today. I stayed in California for about 6 months, tried burglary out there. They were a lot more smarter than here. I almost got caught 4 or 5 times. Moved around the United States on the run, knowing I was wanted in Florida. And then I came back to Florida because a friend of mine was having a party. And I came back. I stayed with a friend whose mother went in our bedroom and saw all kinds of other substances in my briefcase and in my duffel bag. And she called the cops because she knew where we were going to be. And the Maitland Police Department pulled up. And sure enough, they were only looking for me. They weren't looking to break up the party. And they came in and they arrested me. It wasn't pretty. I pulled a gun on one of the detectives who wound up being the police chief and retiring at Maitland. And through the grace of God, he didn't shoot me. He had every right to shoot me because I was pointing a gun at him and I was out of my mind. But for some reason, he just kept yelling my name and he knew me. He'd arrested me enough times. And he didn't kill me. They took me to jail. And I, like I said, I had a very extensive rap sheet. And the judge looked at me, and I just turned 18 years old, and he says, you know, I just don't see any hope for you. I'm sentencing you to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida, and I'm 18 years old. And you want to talk about fear? Now, I have a second case of hepatitis, so I'm in an isolation cell at the time. And the only book in that cell was a Bible. And I can tell you, for 2 weeks, all I did, day and night, was hold that Bible and pray, please God, don't let him do this to me. Please God, don't let him do this to me. And God was there. God has always been listening to me, and I know that now. Because I was taken back before that same judge, and he said, I had a change of heart. I'm going to give you 18 months on a chain gang. And Orange County still had chain gangs in. They had taken the chains off, and, you know, nowadays when you see work release prisoners out there with weed eaters and blowers and everything, not in 1972 they didn't. They had these sickles and swing blades, and you were in the ditch and you didn't move without saying, moving up, boss. You see the movie Cool Hand Luke, everything except the chains, that's what we went through. And it was really punishment. I mean, it was just out and out slave labor. But I could see, you know, I could see, because even though when we had visitors, you had a little wire mesh screen, and so they couldn't really bring you alcohol, but they could bring you all those other things, and the guards always sat at the end and slept, and so passing things through. So I had my intoxicants for a while, but I could see a progression that, you know, I didn't want to be in that ditch. You know, I fell out the first 3 weeks. They had to put me under the truck every day because, you know, here's a little wimpy guy just coming out of hepatitis for the second time. I couldn't swing that blade all day in Florida heat. Couldn't do it. And no, they didn't, if you fell out, they didn't call an ambulance to take you to the hospital. They stuck you under the truck. At the end of the day, they loaded you in the truck and you went back to the prison farm. But the progression I was talking about is I wanted to get out of that ditch, and so I could see that the trustees, all they had to do is serve the food, bring you water, and sharpen the blades. And so I wanted to be a trustee. And then after I got to be a trustee, you know, I wanted to get back inside the building. Because the place is making 150 meals 3 times a day, because that's how many people were out there. There's something in that kitchen I was shooting for, you know. And I was shooting for that kitchen for a reason, because they had everything in there that you needed to put in a can, mix it up, put it on a top shelf, let it ferment for a couple of weeks, and you could get drunk. Now, when Dr. Silkworth wrote the doctor's opinion, the biggest thing that ever kicked out of me was I drank the nastiest alcohol ever on earth while I was in the chain gang. And I made it. But I drank it because of the effect. And that's exactly what it says. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I love that effect. No matter how it was killing me, no matter what it was doing to me, I like the effect of alcohol. I did my time there. I got out of the jail or the chain gang, successfully completed a probation parole period, and went right back to drinking like a crazy man. You know, I was drunk every day, I was doing crazy things. I never wanted to go back to jail, but I never thought that I would, you know. And a couple of years later, I was arrested again. They dropped the charges. I started saying, okay, I don't need to do that stuff anymore. You know, I really don't want to do that. 1978, I met a little girl in Columbus, Mississippi. We fell in lust. I want to call it love, but we really fell in lust because our first date was taking some drugs, drinking a lot of alcohol, getting naked, and going to bed. That was our first date, and that's how I dated. You know, that's an alcoholic date right there. And she never was an alcoholic. She was just a scared girl that left home at 18 and never had seen anything in the world, and I was a worldly man at the time, and so, you know, we wound up getting married, and we had a marriage for almost 21 years. When we were married 17 years, she was able to carry a baby to almost full term. And I like to say I have a little boy named Forrest. Some of you who know him know he's not a little boy. He's bigger than me almost right now. He's almost 16 years old. But that was the only thing I ever wanted, man. I wanted a son. And 4 years later, I'm sitting there drinking so much at night that I'm wet in the bed. You know, I'm back to my childhood. My disease had progressed so far that I couldn't wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. And my ex-wife put up with it once, twice, three times, and she moved out of the bedroom. And we started going right towards the divorce. And I started drinking harder. I just started hammering it. Now, I will tell you this. One of my biggest problems when I got here was I didn't drink during the day. And I never drank with clients. And so in my business, that was very important to me that I would not get up in the morning. And so I didn't relate at first to the people who said they got up in the morning and had a drink, or that they had to drink all day long. When 5 o'clock came, I started hammering back malt liquor on the way home until I got home, and then I started hammering back, you know, the cheapest alcohol I could buy, but it was enough to get me drunk every single night. And she had decided that she didn't want that anymore. She said she wanted a divorce, and in a drunken fury, I said, I will sign anything you want and allow you to take my son anywhere you want. Just get away from me and my bottle. And that's what I did. I gave my son up to somebody else to raise. He lives 650 miles away from me right now. He's the biggest thrill in my life. He's 16 almost now, and he ain't got time for dad anymore. He's got a girlfriend, he's got Facebook, he's got computers, he's got everything. We used to talk for hours at night. We used to watch cartoons together because I had a phone plan, unlimited. And now I can't get him to return a text. Damn. Kind of like his dad. You know? But everything I wrote in that divorce decree, including way too much money, I have paid every month. I have never been late. I've never missed a child support payment, a health insurance payment, a school payment. You know, the man that she married is a wonderful man. He is a wonderful retired firefighter. And, you know, just a nice guy who raised my son to be a good kid. And he doesn't like school. You know, my son doesn't like school. And he's been to thousands of meetings with me, because when he's with me in the summer or the holiday breaks or anything else, if he goes to Central and it's a closed meeting, he sits at the coffee bar. If he goes to another group with me, there's usually a room for him to be able to sit in. He's gone with me to speak at meetings where people from the intergroup were there, and he sat in the back of the room and did intergroup, stamping the envelopes for intergroup and things like that. And the reason I drag him to all these meetings is so he'll know where it is. He'll know where Alcoholics Anonymous is if that time comes in his life that he ever needs help. He'll know where to find it. Now, I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and I'll continue to say that until a minute. But what happened was my wife at the time, before we got a divorce, and I agreed that we were going to do this divorce very kindly, very quietly. We weren't going to trash each other. And the very next day I went by my father's house, and my ex-wife, or my wife, had been there and told my father and my stepmother that I was peeing in the bed and I was drunk all the time, and she just trashed me to hell and back. And I'm like, geez. And I knew my stepmother worked for the Hillsborough County Court System. I just never asked her what she did. She was retired. And she looked at me and said, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and your wife needs to go to Al-Anon. And my wife said, I don't have a problem. And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't need to go to whatever Alcoholics Anonymous is. Well, my stepmother worked for the judges in Tampa, and she was the one who evaluated the drunk drivers to tell them how many meetings they had to go to AA and get their papers signed. I can't tell you how many thousands of papers I've signed since I've been sober and chaired meetings, but that was the first of what I called at the time a coincidence, and in a minute I'll tell you that I don't believe in coincidences. There's just too much proof that God's in my life, and God's in your life too, whether you know it or not. Everybody in this room has been touched by the hand of God, and I know that. I wasn't coming here. I had no reason to. I'm not an alcoholic. But a friend of mine who was 10 years younger than me had a real bad drinking problem, real bad drinking problem. And finally his family said, don't come home anymore if you're drunk. And he lived up in Volusia County on the back of a dirt road, and he got drunk, and he parked a car on that dirt road, and he set it on fire, and he burned himself to death. And I was just horrified. You know, I went to his funeral, and I always remember this, this Irish Catholic priest up there with a big red nose. I thought he'd been drinking, and, you know, he probably hadn't, but I thought he had. And something about what happened at that funeral, that I sat there and said, God, I'll go to one meeting. I'll go to one meeting just to tell those drunks that if they don't quit drinking, they're probably going to kill themselves. And I walked into Central at a noon meeting. I didn't hear anything anybody said. They got around to me. I burst out in tears. I blabbered about my friend killing himself, and I did say, if you drunks don't stop drinking, you're going to kill yourself. And there's a man sitting right there with 32 years of sobriety. And the whole room, I'm sure they laughed. I just don't remember it. You know, I don't remember it. I was just full of tears. But a little girl was sitting next to me, and I've come to love her. She goes to Central, and she tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. And I got up and left. I wasn't coming back. A man stalked me down the street from the meeting. My office is only a block away, and, you know, this guy was just behind me going, I know how you feel, and I know what you're thinking. You know, just come back tomorrow. You know, and I just turned around and said, I'm going to have you arrested if you don't leave me alone. You know, you're stalking me. Now, what happened? I came back the next day. I came back the next day and said, I can't quit drinking. I didn't hear him say, get a sponsor, work the steps, ask God for help. I didn't hear any of that. I could only hear Jim. I was pretty self-centered. I still have that problem sometimes, but not as bad as when I first got here. And for 27 days, I went to a noon meeting every day and said, I can't stop drinking. And there was an older Jewish man named Leo, and he spoke at a lot of places around town. He's got a lot of people into the program. And he looked at me on a Friday noon meeting when I was crying and said, why don't you go home and just drink a bottle of arsenic and get it over with? I'm tired of seeing you try to kill yourself slowly. And that old man made me so mad. I don't recommend it, but I went home and got sober on a resentment. And that was the first time I'd ever stopped drinking in 30 plus years. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. And I got drunk again. I would get brief periods of recovery, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. I would pray, and I would get recovery. But I wouldn't get what you all were promising me. I didn't get that peace of mind. I didn't get that amazing life that you all guaranteed me if I worked these steps. And I went 9 months without a drink and went to a meeting. It was a speaker meeting at Central, and a guy from another group was speaking, and a friend of mine said, why don't you come hear him speak? And all that guy could see me doing the whole night was I was looking up there at this guy, and I looked like that bobble-headed doll in the back of the car. I just nodded my head. Everything he said, man, that was me, including drinking Schlitz malt liquor. You know, that was my drink of choice, and I never heard anybody else say that was his drink of choice. And after the meeting, this guy took me over to him and said, why don't you come up and shake his hand and tell him thanks? And I was, there's a whole crowd around him, and I'm saying, no, not right now. and oh, come on. And Dan kind of parted everybody out of the way like Moses parts the Red Sea and walks me up to a guy named Joe and says, Joe, this is my friend Jim. He needs a sponsor. And I was stuck. I mean, I couldn't say, no, I don't. You know, I don't have one, but no, I don't. And I just picked up a nine-month chip at that speaker meeting. Gone 9 months without a drink. And this is where there's no coincidence in my life ever again after that day. I took out my business card, and on the back side of it, I wrote down my phone number, and I handed it to Joe, and I said, why don't you call me Monday if you want to sponsor me? He took out his business card, and on the white side, he said, and he wrote down his phone number, he said, why don't you call me Monday if you want me to sponsor you? Oh, that's how it works, huh? Okay. We turned those two cards over, and I worked for Coldwell Banker Commercial Real Estate in Orlando, and he worked for Coldwell Banker Real Estate in Winter Park, and we had never met in our life. And that right there sealed it for me. And he said, are you done drinking? And I said, yeah, I'm done drinking. He said, are you sure? I said, I'm pretty sure. Well, I wasn't. Following day, I decided after 9 months of not having a drink, I could have one drink. I could take a drink. Now, this is an alcoholic thinking for you. I can take a drink, so I bought a half gallon. I didn't buy a shooter. I didn't buy 1 ounce. I bought a half gallon because sometime maybe 2 years from now, I might want another drink, right? Monday morning, I came to on my kitchen floor with my face plastered to that floor. I'll never forget it. I don't ever want to forget it. And half that half gallon was gone, and I didn't spill any of it. I did look around. I looked around to see if I spilled it, but I didn't. And I called Joe, and I said, "This is what I did." And I guess he could hear the desperation in my voice. He knew that that was it. And he said, "Pour the rest of it out. Go to your noon meeting and pick up a white chip. And I'll meet you at 1:30, and we'll start working the steps." And we worked the first three steps that day. And I'll be forever grateful for it. I was just invited to his 50th birthday party, and that was kind of fun, too. Worked the steps, and all of a sudden, my life changed. Not only was I healthier, I was happier, I was thrilled, and I started living the amazing dream that you can get from working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a piece of property up in Georgia a few years ago. I've been always wanting to move back to Georgia. I only wanted to grow an acre, 2 acres maybe. And I found 50 acres up there. And my brother and I, my older brother and I, lived over in Winter Park on one of those brick streets that are so important to people. And right before the real estate crash, we were able to sell the house that we had inherited from my father. He passed away 7 days after I got sober. And buy 50 acres up in Georgia, build a couple houses, a barn, and pay for it cash from the profit we had off that house. That's amazing. And I moved to Georgia, and I sat there in my home group at Central day after day talking about moving to my dream. I've got my dream. I've bought my dream. I'm moving to my dream. And one day a guy walked up to me and said, get another dream. And I was like, what do you mean, get another dream? I've got my dream. He goes, yeah, you got your dream. Now get another dream. You're limiting God's power by only having one dream. And I understood what he said. Not right away, but it took me a while. And I moved up there. And I was living up there for a couple of years. There was a little bit of insanity. There was no drinking. I had no clue it was a dry county because it didn't bother me. You know. And one day my brother said, you know, you bought us a property in a dry county. And I went, did I? You know, 45 miles for him to go get a bottle of booze. And he only drinks one. He drank maybe a drink or two a year. You know, he was an alcoholic when he was teaching school, and they gave him a choice, either stop drinking or lose your job. And he stopped drinking, but he didn't want anything to do with spirituality. He didn't want to do anything today. He didn't want to hear about God. Well, that's the only thing that brought me back, I know, today, is when I looked up on the wall and I saw the word God. Somehow or another, that brought me back. That didn't scare me away. I lived up there a couple of years. About 8-10 miles away, there's a town. They have a group there. They have a building. It wasn't like what I was brought up on. It wasn't the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't the fellowship. They like to talk about tractors and cottonseed, and I don't know anything about tractors and cottonseed. So 60 miles away in Albany, there's a Central Albany group, and I joined that. and I would drive 60 miles one way three or four times a week so I could go to a closed discussion or a literature meeting and talk with real alcoholics. And that's still my home group when I'm in Georgia. I still will drive that 60 miles to go to a meeting because those people up there probably saved my life and didn't know it, because I was in the middle of nowhere. Now, I became a volunteer firefighter and an EMT and things like that so I could still help people, because that's what our program teaches us, to help fellows around us, be of maximum service to God and our fellows, not just strictly limited to Alcoholics Anonymous. But 2 years ago, that was 4 years ago when I moved up there, I was up there 2 years, and I was coming back every month, every couple of months, so I could see my friends at Central. And I was doing some speaking up there like I do every now and then when I'm asked down here, and I got a telephone call. My little brother was 10 years younger than me, and the phone call was he got his fifth DUI felony. And I came down and tough loved him. You know, this family's not paying for any more attorneys. We're not paying for any of your stuff. You're going to go to jail, and then you're going to do your probation, and we're just, you're cut off. You know, you'll get a little stipend every now and then, but you're cut off. And so I tough loved him, and he called me the rat bastard to all his friends, and that was my nickname for everybody that knew me, that knew him, was the rat bastard. I was trying to help him. I was trying to get him into the fellowship, and he didn't want anything to do with it. And then 2 years ago in October, I got a phone call out of the blue from somebody down here who said, your brother's in a coma in the intensive care ward, and he doesn't have a lot of time left. And my dad's gone, my mom's gone, my older sister's gone, and so I'm kind of in charge of the family, and so I put on this I'm in charge hat, and I got ready to rush out of my house in Georgia, and this person said to me, I'm a friend of Bill W.'s, and I've heard you speak. And boy, if you would, there was somebody, one of us, was with my little brother. That's all it took. Somebody was taking care of him that was sober and knew this program. So I didn't have to rush down here. I came down in a couple of days and found out that he had about 6 months to 2 years to live. And he had 10 brain cancers, or 10 tumors in his brain, 3 in his lungs, a couple on his liver. This is all due to untreated alcoholism. And I had seen people die in the rooms, and I knew this was going to be a long struggle. But he was wearing an electronic bracelet on his ankle, and that was not to GPS monitor him, it was to monitor his sweat glands. And so he hadn't had a drink in over a year after his DUI, fifth DUI. And all he kept saying is, if I've only got so much time to live, can you get this thing off of me, Jim? And I said, yeah. So we went to his probation officer, I gave him the medical records, we cut that thing off his ankle, they waived all the rest of his probation, waived all his fines, and said he can leave the state any time. And we did a bucket list, we were going to have all this fun time, we were going to do all these great things. But what my little brother wanted to do was drink. And he picked up right where he left off. And 30 days later, he blew out an ulcer, perforated his little intestine. They called me in Georgia and said, he's got to go in for emergency surgery, and you're his health care provider, and he's a DNR. What do you want us to do? And I thought, well, they can fix this, maybe. Yeah, do it. And then when he came out of surgery, the same person called me again and said, you need to get down here. And I said, nah, it's the middle of rutting season up in Georgia, meaning the deer are running all over the place, and I don't want to be driving at night to do that. And I hung up the phone. I was going to come down the next morning. And then God said, get in the car. And so I drove down here and got down here at 11:30 at night and held his hand at 3 o'clock in the morning when he died. And he was 44 years old. It's a killer disease. It says so in the book. You know, in the very beginning of the book, it talks about how we've recovered from alcoholism. The 100 people that wrote this book. And I've recovered from alcoholism. I still have to recover from Jimism. I have to recover from myself trying to take my will back. And I have to do some other things, some simple things, but I have to do some other things. You know, I have to carry this message to alcoholics. And I have to practice these principles in all my affairs, and I fall short. I fall short every day. But with the memory of my little brother, I came back to Orlando. I moved back to Orlando. I have that property in Georgia. My brother's up there taking care of it. I go up there now. It's beautiful to go visit it. I don't want to live in the woods anymore. I want to live where there's people. You know, that whole area up there, the entire county had one stoplight at it, and they're just, if you called 911 and said, I'm having a heart attack, they say, you're going to die. By the time the paramedic leaves his house, goes to the hospital, gets an emergency room nurse, gets in the ambulance, and drives across the county, you're probably going to die, you know. But I came back here and I threw myself into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read every book I could find written by Bill and Bob. Bob didn't write very many books. I read histories. I read biographies. I got involved. And I'm really involved in the history of this program because, my opinion, you know, this is a divinely inspired program. Treatment centers are detoxes, and this one was God introducing one drunk to another because nobody else knew how to get sober. But one drunk talking to another, telling their story, not preaching to them, but telling their story. That's how this thing started in 1935. 4 years later, 100 of them were sober and they wrote a book. You know? And it's a basic text. It's a textbook on how to live life. There is no graduation date in that book. Nor is there anything in that book or the other book that I read that says that God's going to wake me up tomorrow. You know? The only promises I get are in this book right here, in my other book, saying if you do the right thing, if you follow the principles in this book, your life is going to be wonderful today. You know? If I wake you up today, God's telling me, you're going to have a great day if you keep doing the right thing. But He doesn't promise me He's going to wake me up tomorrow. He doesn't promise any of you all that. And that's why I really believe this is one day at a time program. I get up each morning and I say the same thing I said 9 years ago. You know, keep me away from a drink, God. Please, let me do something on your behalf. And I say some other prayers too, but that's my main one. And really my main one is the first sentence in the Serenity Prayer. To grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change. Because I was taught about a hula hoop and to stay inside my hula hoop. Inside my hula hoop is God and me, nobody else. And everything outside my hoop is just none of my damn business. So I don't know a lot of people's last names unless I become extremely friendly with them. You know, and I'm friendly to everybody, but, you know, almost... I had sponsees. I didn't know their last name. I had a sponsee a little while ago kill himself. 44 years old, same age as my brother, but he committed suicide because he just couldn't believe... He was so smart. He had 4 degrees, master's degrees... He was just so smart, he couldn't believe that there was a power out there greater than himself. And he committed suicide. And we have a saying at Central, we bury the smart ones all the time. You know, we really do. They try to analyze a program that doesn't need to be analyzed. It needs to be worked. It's an action program, and you got to take the action to save your own life. And that's what I had to do. I had to save my own life. The big book has all kinds of promises in it. It's got a lot of threats in it too. If you do this, you know, resentment's the number one offender. If you drink, you're going to die. Those are all true, and I've watched them all happen over and over. But it's got all kinds of promises. You know, it promises me a new freedom and a new happiness that I never had before. And in the very beginning of Bill's story, way early on, it talks about, you know, if you're going to turn your alcohol problem over to God, why aren't you going to turn all your problems over to God? If God could relieve me of that obsession to drink alcohol, and I couldn't stop on my own, I could not. And you couldn't make me stop. But trusting in God, I was able to stop drinking. And trusting in God today, I'm able to turn over my finances, my health, my romances, and let God be in charge of those things. Because in the very first step, I said, I'm not in charge anymore. I am not a manager. You know, why is a management question? And I say that all the time. And I'm not in management. I'm in labor. I need to do the work. I need to carry the message. I need to let people know there's hope. I've been privileged to be asked by one of the committees at Intergroup, and I encourage any young people to contact Intergroup and volunteer to go into high schools. to go into high school. God, figure that. Me. Guy never liked school in his life, can't wait to go into high school. You know? And share the message. Not the message of just say no or don't drink, you're going to get, you know, in trouble. You know, that's not my message. My message is when you start drinking and doing other things, and when your life becomes so bad, you don't have to go 30 years. There's a building around the corner from you. There's a building down the street. In this town, there's 139 groups holding 454 meetings a week of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so all I do is spread the word that there's help out there for you. I plant a seed, kind of like Dick planted in me. And it's a thrill when you see somebody coming into a meeting and saying, I really need help. You know, I don't want to drink. I turn 21 next week and I don't want to drink. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, you're not even allowed to drink yet and you don't want to drink. God bless you. And we have some young people getting sober in Central. You all have them here. They're all over. There are millions of people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk talking to another drunk, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I never knew that what you all were going to do is you were going to put some kind of responsibility on me. You know? I never understood that. All I wanted to do was stop drinking. And then after I stopped drinking and started working the steps and then started implementing those steps in my daily life, I found that y'all had hidden something somewhere. It's on a plaque all the time, but I never read it, you know, that I was responsible. That anywhere, anyone reaching out their hand for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I am responsible. Thanks for letting me share.